Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from optimistic FYP studios East and West. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 158 of Registry Matters. Larry, it is freezing cold Saturday night, and I hope it's warmer over there, but I bet it's not. How are you?
It's not much warmer. It's like, I think it was the high today was going to be like 42. And it goes.
And no humidity. Ugh. Well, I guess it's actually better.
And then it's going to be 22, 24 tonight for the average low. And then the low varies according to what part of the city you're in, because the lower elevations down in the valley, the cold just settles down and it gets colder in the valley.
Right. And then it's that dry cold. I don't know. I guess it's better than being humid. Humid cold. If it gets cold in New Orleans, where I used to live, man, it's murder because it just eats right through your clothes.
That's what I've heard.
All right. Well, let's do this real quick. Give us a quick little rundown on the late breaking news coming out of Michigan.
Well, there's a legislative proposal that has landed on the governor's desk that is going to change some provisions of Michigan's Sex Offender Registration Act to bring the state in compliance with federal court orders. And we're going to be digging into that quite a bit later in the program. So
such a curmudgeon voicemail thing that we had last week?
Oh, I don't think so. This is actually a positive news. But yeah, we're going to be taking a deeper dive into it. And this is from my point of view, good news. It's not as good as some would like, but it's certainly good news.
All right. Well, I will stop the news sounder part. And then what else do we have going on tonight?
We have three questions that have come to us by audio file. One question from prison, if you can read it. I had put a note on there that you might have trouble reading it. And so we got four questions. We got the deep dive on Michigan, and then we're going to be talking about Louisiana's petition to the Supreme Court regarding their loss in their own state Supreme Court. They're going to U.S. Supreme Court. And we've got a couple, three articles to talk about if we have time.
Wow. Okay, so a mountain of content. Do you want to start with the voicemail messages?
Let's do it.
All right, the first two are from Jason, but here we go.
Hey, this is Jason calling in from Michigan. I had a quick question about the 48-hour rule in Florida. My wife and I and my young son were thinking of trying a weekend getaway there. I know. It's the worst place to go, but it is what it is. So my question is that 48 hours 48 business hours or 48 hours like 24/7? Meaning, do I only have Monday to Friday to do it so I can maybe fly in Friday, leave Sunday, and not have to worry about that? Any info would be great. Thank you, and FYP.
Well, thank you for doing the obligatory FYP part. I can imagine, Larry, that some states would only do it like on business sort of days, but I just have a feeling that Florida's apparatus is set up in such a way that it is from the moment you cross the state line, you have 48 hours.
He should understand that Florida has the largest fleet of hovercraft of any state. And they have sensors like what you see, remember seeing on the Star Trek episodes, and they know when you're getting within a proximity of Florida, and they assign a craft just to you. So that's what's
going on. So you have your own individual. Hey, will this thing do any food delivery? If you have a personal hovercraft, maybe they could pick up some groceries for you.
I don't know if they'll do that type of service, but they will monitor you for the entire time you're in Florida. And they know when you're approaching their airspace. And well, they have sensors.
Okay, but seriously though, so I know we joke about the hovercraft a lot, but seriously, is it from the time that you like touch down into Florida? Is it the time that you like take up residency at a hotel or something like that? When does the 48 hours begin?
Well, I'm going to punt on that one and tell him to call attorney Gil Shaffnet and ask that question, since I'm not licensed to practice law. But I can tell you that in my research I did in preparing for the podcast, I could not find in the statute a definition of how they measure that time. I did not do case law research to figure out if there's been any interpretation where the judges have had to draw their own conclusion of what 48 hours meant. But I take a little issue with the 48 hours because I don't read the statute the same way he does. And again, I am not an attorney. I am the person who provides the research to attorneys who asked me to tell them what the law means. And I go dig through it and I say, this is what it means and here's why. But the attorney has to sign off on my opinion because I'm not authorized to give it. But when I'm looking at the statute, I don't see it that way. It defines in Florida statutes, they refer you to the Florida Sexual Predators Act for the definition of temporary and permanent residencies. So you look at the Sex Offender Registration Act, and it refers you to another place. So I've got both in Dropbox, and we can provide it to the listener. But if you look on page one of the Florida statute 943.0435, it says permanent residents, temporary residents, or transient residents have the same meaning as provided in section 775.21, which is in the Florida Sexual Predators Act. And so when you go look at that, what it says is temporary residence means any place where the person abides, lodges, or resides, including but not limited to vacation, business, or personal travel destinations in or out of the state for a period of 3 or more days in the aggregate during any calendar year, and which is not the person's permanent address. And I'll stop there. But that seems to qualify for what he's describing. This would seem to be a temporary residence where the person abides or lodges or resides for a vacation or business or personal travel in the state of Florida. So 3 is more than 48. So that's what I'm reading in the statute. And these statutes are current, as like I said, I pulled them today. And so I don't know where he's getting the 48 hours now. If you're moving to Florida for permanent status, it does say 48 hours. You've got 48 hours to comply with all the registry requirements if you're going to become a resident or a student or anything that triggers a continuous attachment to Florida. But I don't read it the same way in terms of a temporary visit. I'm sorry. That's just what I see.
Okay. So let's backpedal. Just if you're moving to the state, you have to go report in within the 48 hours. If you are temporarily visiting, are you, in your opinion, not legal, you, Larry, the private citizen visiting the wonderful state of Florida, you think it's 3 days?
Well, I'm going by what the statute says. In the definitions, it says what a temporary residence is. And it can't be any clearer to me that it's 3 or more days in the aggregate during any calendar year. And 48 is not 3.
This is true. I got to agree with you that 3 is more than 48.
So therefore, it would be my non-legal opinion that a temporary residence that did not consume more than 3 days. Now, I can't answer this question about whether they're business or cumulative. It seems like since they don't address it, that the tie generally, the rule of lenity, which means that the ambiguity is resolved in favor of the defendant. If I were defending the case, I would argue the rule of lenity. Well, you know, obviously everything's not open on business days, on non-business days. So therefore, this meant business days, and the tie goes to the runner. But clearly, on his point, 48 hours is not what I see in the law. I see 3 days.
Interesting. I've always heard Florida is 48 hours.
Because everybody reads it the same way you do. If you're forming a temporary attachment, that's different than if you're forming a permanent attachment to Florida. If you're going to reside there or become a student or become an employee there, there's one set of rules. But like I say, I'm just going by what the law says, what a temporary residence means and what qualifies. And it doesn't seem to be a 48-hour requirement as far as I can see.
Okay. Interesting. Well, those documents will be in the show notes if you want to go track those down. And those will be found at registrymatters.co. And you can click on the specific show to get to the show notes and you will find the PDFs that Larry has provided from there. And then Jason has yet another question, so we will go over to that one.
Hi, this is Jason again from the great state of Michigan. And second question I wanted to ask regarding the bill that's about to pass in Michigan about the unconstitutionality of the offender registry per the paperwork that the part about 25 years, when they forced us to go from 25 years to life, was deemed unconstitutional. And so anyone pre-2011 was supposed to be set back to their original 25 years. Nowhere in the new bill does it even so much as mention that. So they are ignoring that part and not even mentioning it. My question, I guess, to Larry, since he's the legal guy, how can a bill like this pass when it doesn't meet all the federal judges' unconstitutionality parts? And if they can pass without meeting all of the parts, doesn't that just leave the state open to more and more lawsuits? Any information on this would also be greatly appreciated. Thanks, guys. FYP.
Interesting. So he gets roped into the 25-year registration, but then it got moved to life, and I think that's what he's asking?
That is what he's asking. And the there was many questions buried in there. And the one that I like the most is, how can they do it? Because they're allowed to do whatever they want to do. They're a legislative body. And the federal judge has no control over what they legislate out of their chambers.
And they can legislate. Isn't it because it's a civil regulatory scheme?
Well, let me finish this part first.
Okay.
They can legislate anything they want to. The federal court can only tell them afterwards if it can be enforced and if it's constitutional. But there is in no way any limitation on their. I mean, they can litigate that the sun goes down at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Legislate that. I mean, not litigate. And they can do anything they want to. Courts cannot tell legislative bodies what they can and cannot do. And I can't say that emphatically enough. They can do, they're a co-equal branch of government. They can do whatever the heck they want to do. The only question becomes whether or not it's constitutional. I don't read the Doe's decision the same way he's reading it. I do. I've looked at it very carefully. I looked at it again before the podcast. He's reading more into it than what they actually said. The language in the Doe's decision didn't say that they were so worried about the increase in the term of registration. What concerned them was the tiering, which this bill addresses. The tiering, because the public associates the tier levels with a level of dangerousness, because that's just the way with the limited knowledge people have about the registry, they've heard that three is bad. You know, level three is bad. Well, a tier three is not the same thing as a level three, but that's what the public associate with. So this legislation takes the tier designations off the registry. That's all the court said. If he can find where, and I may have overlooked it in my skim read in preparation, but I do not believe that there's anything in there that says you shall be restored to your original term of registration. That's something that people wanted to see happen, because when they did prior to the to them passing their version of the Adam Walsh Act, the terms of registration, they didn't have a lifetime in Michigan. And some of the people that were planning to get off the registry all of a sudden found themselves in a tier three category, which means their lifetime. And they're of course, who would want lifetime when they had 20 years or 25, whichever it was, I get it confused, but they had a period where they had hope of being off the registry. And now all of a sudden this fix, it takes their tier designation off, which is what the public was told about them without due process, that you're dangerous, you're level three. but their registration terms are not changing as a result of this legislation. Does it open the door to more litigation? Absolutely it does. Unless there's something I don't know, that litigation will fail because the case did not order them to put people back in their original terms, at least not the way I read it.
Okie dokie. And then I like this question the best. I didn't catch who this was from, but this, let's run this. Did you give me a name and where this is coming from? Does he say it in the call?
I think he says it in there. It came to the NARSL legal line. So we decided that I'd like to try to answer it on the podcast.
Sure. Okay. Here we go.
Hello. My name is Tom. I'm a sex offender, and I was wondering, my probation officer is asking me for username and passwords so I can access the internet, and this is a requirement for monitoring process. Just tell me if this is legal. My number is 402-800.
Sorry. I will cut that out. All right. So
37,
can they ask for passwords?
37,000 people just heard that.
Yes. I will have to make sure that I go back and clip that out.
So the answer is, as King Alexander and I are fond of saying, they can do it until they're stopped. But more precisely, what we don't know would be very helpful. What we don't know is this a standardized condition of supervision for everyone who has a registration obligation while they're under supervision? And I'm guessing that's Nebraska. I know that's a 402 area code out of Omaha area, but that doesn't mean he's registering there. That 402 number could be anywhere now. But the supervising authorities, that's not so uncommon. I've heard of it. This is not the first time. And the same question is, can they do that? And the answer is probably. But we don't know until we have litigation in your jurisdiction. And whether or not you would prevail would depend on if they can articulate. Remember, they can do almost anything to a supervised offender if they're narrowly tailoring it to you. If your offense was so egregious that it involved the internet, and you're lucky to be free, and the judge was giving you a very, very tight rope in the conditions of probation, saying that you're lucky I didn't send you the pen, but you're going to be on the strictest monitoring that they've got, then if that's narrowly tailored to you, the answer is they probably can do it. And certainly they're going to be able to do it until they're stopped by a court.
How far does that go? Does that mean bank passwords? I got to think the answer becomes no.
I would hope so. But again, this is an area where we don't have a lot of litigation. Being that you have a diminished expectation of privacy, and probation officers are able to monitor your financial transactions, how much privacy do you have? We'd have to see the case law in that jurisdiction, what has been challenged and what the appellate courts have held. But you don't have the same privacy expectations. People engage in criminality of a financial nature, and one of your PO's job is to make sure you're not continuing to do that. So monitoring your finances is not so unreasonable.
Monitoring it from the point of view of being handed a bank statement is different than having access to actually initiate transfers. And I know, we consider and talk about that they're pure as a wind driven snow, blah, blah, blah. They could start getting into shenanigans if they logged into your account.
They could. And they could not only do stuff like that, they could set a person up for criminality, make it look the way they did it. I don't know enough about the internet, but I know a tech person is going to tell me, well, they logged in using the correct password. Sure seems like it was you. And then you got to get into the IP address and if you can trace down where the origin of that was. And in the meantime, you're in handcuffs and sitting in detention.
Mm-hmm. And if they also then have your phone, maybe you had some sort of extra authentication turn on. They have made all the steps in play to get in there that they could do not so nice things. But at the same time, if you have extra employment, you may be depositing checks in there. Now you're in violation from other things. I mean, I can see why they would want to do it. Maybe you're like, but having access that way seems really could be very problematic for them to have direct access to be able to initiate transfers to their own personal PayPal account.
Well, I'd like to see the additional follow-up question on this, and I think I may reach out and ask more specifics if this is narrowly tailored or if this is a generalized condition, and see if it is Nebraska, and see if it is, in fact, state or federal.
A listener listening live right now says in Florida they get your screen names, so they would get your usernames, but they would not necessarily get, they would not get your passwords. That lets them become your friend, I guess, on Facebook, but they don't get to log in and act on your behalf. That's crazy. Oh. That's very problematic to me.
So it is to me as well.
All right. I'm going to do my damnedest to read this question. Like the penmanship, we keep talking about penmanship. The penmanship is quite good, but it's written, it's just hard to read. All right. So this person has been, his offense occurred in 95 and he was sentenced back in 98. And this was before most of all the registry stuff, like I guess really kicked in. And he goes, my questions are, am I obligated to, what is that word? Register, even though it did not exist during the time of my offense. It's one. Two, once released, am I obligated to submit form agreements to the terms of North Carolina Sex Offender Registry without receiving prior notice of the condition via a plea agreement or callback hearing prior? That's too complicated for me to even comprehend, Larry. And can you cover those first two before I get to the third one?
So the answer is yes, you're obligated to register even though it did not exist during the time you committed. Because remember, it's a civil obligation. It's not a part of your punishment. And the ex post facto prohibition only comes into play constitutionally, and the federal constitution, that is, for criminal penalties. This is a civil regulatory scheme that can have a significant penalty if you don't comply with it, but theoretically it's a regulation. And until proof is put forth in North Carolina that shows to a state or federal court, and there are many cases pending in North Carolina, but until the registry is declared punishment, the answer is yes. So number one, they can do it.
And number two, they can also do it. And then so number three, what can they do to me if I refuse to sign forms agreeing to terms of NC PFR registry? I'm sure other offenders share my plight across the Americas.
Well,
so what can they do?
That's what. Well, you know, I'm going to split hairs here. I'd have to read the statute to see if he's required to sign the forms. Being required to comply is one thing. You need to look at the statute and see if you're required to sign is another. And if your statute doesn't say you have to sign anything, when they come out to your house and knock at the door, I tell people you ain't got to sign anything. Now, you're going to make them mad if you don't, but in most jurisdictions, there's nothing that requires you to sign anything at the door when they intrude on your privacy. And they have a clipboard and they say, would you sign this? I mean, you do it because you want to get along with them. But unless your statute requires that, what they're attempting to satisfy is the notice obligation so that they can prosecute you, saying that they know that you have this duty to register. If you refuse to sign that, I don't know that that's the only way that they can prove they served you notice. I think they could prove that they served you notice by having a witness attest to it that they personally identified you and they handed you. It's like when you get a summons to court, some people won't accept it.
Just going
to
ask you about
the process or they throw it on the floor. They say you haven't served me. Oh yes, I have. I've served you. Yeah, you can throw it.
I've seen like TV shows where like the person opens the door and the guy just like throws the thing in there and they slam the doors like you've been served. I don't know if that's true or not. I imagine you've worked in areas where that is
true. It is true. It is, as long as you can. So they would appreciate his signature, but I don't know that it would be required for them to show the requisite knowing. See, he wouldn't have been apprised of it because it didn't exist. And so far, we don't have any jurisprudence that requires attorneys and courts to inform you of obligations that might come at you in the future. You know, the Padilla versus Kentucky Supreme Court case, they have to apprise you of what the consequences are that are known at the time. And this wasn't known at the time. If the registry didn't exist at the time, so they wouldn't have been able to apprise him of that duty. But since they've changed the law and included him and made it applicable to offenses that occurred at the time his did, I'm sorry to say, if you don't do it, if you don't comply, they're going to block you up. That's what they're going to do.
I hearken this to back when you were a young little sprout, and they eventually started putting in driver's licenses that at some point in time, there was no such thing as a driver's license, but eventually they put them in and they're like, oh, I've been driving for 100 years. I don't need a driver's license. Well, there's a civil regulatory scheme now, and you do have to go get a driver's license.
Well, and I remember those days very vividly when they...
I'm sure you do. Well, Larry, hey, man, it's that time to move over to this Michigan thing. I'm sure there are many articles out there that cover this, but we have one from Michigan Live, mlive.com. Michigan Senate approves tightened restrictions in Sex Offender Registration Act. And then you have provided a whole battery, a litany of questions for us to dig into all of the nooks and crannies on this outstanding new law that is coming down the pike to Michigan. Shall we begin?
Let's do our best because we've got 7 minutes to cover it.
See, I thought we had till 7:30, so we have four. All right, I will read very quickly. So like a little personal history, the one of the first NARSAL conferences that I was involved with had Miriam Aukerman. Is that her name? Is that the Michigan attorney?
That is. She's with the ACLU of Michigan.
Right, and I remember her doing a presentation. I had no idea. My head was swirling what was going on, but that's like 100 years ago that this started. That would have been 2015, I think, was the first conference in Atlanta. So my understanding is that now it's on the governor's desk, this new law being that's been passed by both houses, I believe. And what's the point? Is she going to sign it, or is she going to veto it?
She's going to sign it.
And why?
Why?
Yeah, why is she going to sign it? Do you have a crystal ball?
Well, she's going to sign it for a couple reasons. First and most important, if she were to veto the bill, thousands of Michiganders would disappear from the registry because their obligation to register has been halted by a federal judge, which is that injunction that was put in place finally after all these years of wrangling, saying that you can no longer enforce this version on people whose convictions, whose conduct predated this. So those people would stay disappeared. So that's not something that Michigan wants to see. And second, the bill passed with significant or almost overwhelming support, and there would be a veto override in short order, and the governor would suffer significant political damage if she vetoed this. So it's not likely there'd be a veto. It's very likely that she'll sign it fairly quickly.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
But, you know, I actually did. I had a conversation with someone about this, and she is in a position as governor. She is putting in mask mandates around the state. And personally, I look at this as being, if you make a mask mandate, you're going to piss off 50%. If you don't make one, you piss off 50%. So, like, I can see that this is like a no-win situation. At least she's reading some kind of science peer-reviewed papers to say that we should be wearing masks. But if she would read the peer-reviewed recidivism rate things for registry stuff, then there would be no reason for her to sign it, because we all know that there's no reason for the registry to exist. It's ineffective, and we can go through all those things there. So why would she then go sign this one if she's doing sciencey things over here and not sciencey things over here?
So I think you're trying to say she's a hypocrite.
Maybe.
Right.
I didn't want to use that word. Okay. Hypocrisy.
So no, she's not being a hypocrite at all. I know that some will see it that way, but we have two different situations here. When you have a public health pandemic, most governors, I think almost, if not all, but certainly the overwhelming majority of them, have been given broad emergency powers by their legislatures. The people have said, you are the day-to-day manager of health crisis. You have these powers. And they've bestowed those powers. It's kind of like the Congress declares wars, the president manages the war. You see the scenario, the president manages the day-to-day affairs of a war.
Yeah.
The commands of how of which battalions or which naval, all that stuff runs through the Pentagon directly to the president. Well, in a health catastrophe, the chief executives of the states have been given broad powers. And therefore, what she's doing is consistent with the power. She does not need to consult with anyone else because she has been empowered. Now, she, of course, does consult with her health officials, whoever her health team is, but she doesn't need to go consult with lawmakers because the power has been bestowed upon her. When it comes to the sex offender registration, no such power has been bestowed upon her. The only power she has is a veto power, and she would have some power with her legislative liaison as it's going through the process of them crafting this legislation to effectuate suggestions. But she doesn't manage the day-to-day affairs of the registry. And the people have spoken loudly and clearly through their elected representatives and senators in Michigan that they want this law. And for her to veto this law, it's like there's no comparison. All the scientific stuff was reviewed, and the opportunity for that discussion was in the legislative process. If you say there's no science, then you needed to convince the legislators that there was no science behind having a registry. And good luck with that, because even without science, Michigan doesn't want an influx of registrants from all over the country of people who have sex offense convictions. So there's just no comparison. She's not being a hypocrite at all. She's doing what's in a veto would be overridden. That's what would happen.
Will in chat said, if she vetoed the bill, the legislators could and probably would override the veto. Can you do me a favor? And in your experience of working with the legislature, I don't ever really hear of vetoes. I guess they happen, but they don't really seem to make the news that I follow, whether it's presidential or at the gubernator level. What, like, do they happen often?
They don't. They don't happen often, but they do happen. And the part-time legislatures, they typically are not overridden because the vast majority of legislation in a part-time 30, 60-day session doesn't get acted upon by the governor until they're out of session. And they can't really override that until they come back into session again. So it's really not practical from the organization of the state. Now, at the U.S. Congress and in the full-time legislatures, which Michigan is, they would be able to reconvene and override the veto. And, you know, I've not been wrong about a whole lot in this case, and I don't believe they would just let the veto stand without attempting to override it. Now, The unknown here is that we're close to a new session because they had elections and there's going to be a new legislature sworn in January. So the question would be, if she did veto, which she's not likely to, because as far as she's concerned, this is fixing a problem and that there was broad support for it. So she's not going to come out of left field and veto this. But if she did, the mechanics of them convening with so few days left in this session, before they swear new members, it might not be possible. But if that did happen, all they would do would be bring the bill back as a reintroduced bill. They would bring back what was passed, this identical version of what was passed. They would run it through again. Probably there would not be significant changes, and they would put it on her desk again. That's what they would do.
And do me a favor, can we circle back to how did we get here? What happened to prompt the legislature? Sure. What prompted the court case for them to bring us to the legislators rewriting the law to begin with?
Well, there were some challenges. There was the big one that people hear about was the Doe versus Snyder case, which was in 2015, filed in U.S. District Court in Michigan, and there was some limited relief granted in the victory. It wasn't what Paul Reingold and Miriam Alkerman were hoping for, but the state appealed because the state doesn't like any relief to be granted. So they appealed. And on appeal, the Sixth Circuit Court actually found that significant violations of the Constitution by the 2006 and 2011 amendments. So the Sixth Circuit gave broader relief than what the trial court had done. And Mr. Reingold said he was surprised that they won on the ex post facto clause because the district court had not given them that victory below. So we ended up with the Doe versus Snyder case, which only was beneficial to those plaintiffs. Well, then the class action lawsuit was filed by another group of registrants, and that's what really has caused this thing to explode, because that case was certified as a class, and relying on the ruling of the and the Doe one, the district judge, which his name was Judge Cleland, he granted and said that the same things that the Doe that applied only to the Doe applied to everybody. So the same findings were applicable to everyone who fit within those pre 2011 offender populations. So all of a sudden, then you had a whole bunch of people in the state of Michigan who were not going to have a potential not have a registration obligation. Well, the Judge Cleland said, "Gee, this is a mess. You guys need to figure out what to do about this unconstitutional problem." And he gave the legislature a whole bunch of time to legislate, but they didn't legislate because they had no incentive to legislate. The law was still being enforced, so finally, after extensive waiting, Judge Cleland finally issued an order. I think it was on my notes here, April 6, 2020, an interim order was issued by Judge Cleland of the Federal District Court of Eastern Michigan. The order prevents law enforcement from enforcing registration, verification of school zone and fee violations connected with Michigan sex offender registry law from February 14, 2020 through the end of the COVID-19 crisis. And then the order does not prohibit people from voluntarily complying. Well, after that order was issued, then the scales changed, because at that particular moment, once there was no longer any enforcement of the registry on a broad swath of people, the legislature felt the need that they would need to do something, and that's how we got this piece of legislation passed. When I say we, that's how it got passed. I didn't have anything to do with passing it, but that's how this ended up passing, was because of the litigation. And the fact that the registry went dark on a whole lot of people in Michigan, and their obligation to report in evaporated.
And from the little bit that I have read, and to me, it looks like there are some good points in there. Can you talk about what is good?
Oh, there's a lot good in there. I mean, I'll never get any credit for being positive, because everybody says I'm doom and gloom. But there's a lot of good in this law. I mean, we can go through all the main points here that are in the law. But they, if you start at the bottom, they modified the definition of convicted, so the people under the Homes Useful Trade Act are clearly covered. They don't have to register. People who get set asides don't have to register. They've been clearly carved out if they complete the obligations of their probation. So I'd consider that a victory. They repealed sections 33, 34, 35, and 36. Those deal with school zone and proximity and residence restrictions. I can't help but see that as positive. I mean, maybe I'm missing something here, but those are positive. So shall I go on? There's a whole bunch of positive in here. There's a couple things that are not as positive that they did some cleanup. The law as it was written said that the obligations were you had to immediately register upon conviction and you had to immediately notify them of all these changes. They clarified that to mean within 3 business days, but I think the courts had already clarified, at least interpreted it that way, that it was three days. But so they cleaned that language up. You've got 3 business days to register or to do updates. And I reckon there's one thing that I'm not too excited about that they did. And that's in terms of the internet addresses that people have to So I'll save that for a little bit. They also they deleted the tier designation, so you won't have on the registry, it'll no longer show you as a tier one, tier two, or tier three. Now the tier ones probably didn't mind it as much because that conveyed that they were not dangerous, but the tier threes minded that a whole lot. And yeah, that was one of the provisions that the court found unconstitutional. They were giving them a ranking in public of being dangerous without any due process because the public perceives those tier designations as a level of dangerousness.
Did they get rid of residency and work restrictions?
Yes, that's the sections 33, 34, 35, and 36. And those deletions appear to apply to everybody. So I would see that as a positive.
That's been my biggest grief of all time. A friend of mine just got out on Thanksgiving Day, and you know he's in a hotel until he can find a place that is more than 1,000 feet from all of the things. And that is one of the biggest barriers that our people have. That would fix the whole Florida thing with the people living in the industrial zone and under bridges.
It would indeed, and I see that as a huge victory. So, folks, I'm being positive. This is so this
mark,
is fantastic.
So mark the date, damn it. It's what happened once this year. All right, let's move on.
There's the part I said I was going to get back to. Now this one, okay. This one is a little bit problematic. And this is where you need a person like me in the drafting because I would have caught this. If you look at number four on my list here, it says that they specifically language says that the reporting electronic mail, all this stuff with the internet, shall only be applied to an individual required to register under the Act after July 1st, 2011. That is very inartfully drafted.
You have written, specify that a requirement to report all electronic mail addresses would apply only to an individual required to be registered under the Act after July 1. That is some wordsmithing right there. Some word salad.
Yes. Okay, but let's see. Our audience really likes textualist judges. And if you want to look at that strictly from a textual interpretation, we think what they were trying to do was to make sure to satisfy the court rulings that anyone who had older convictions prior to 2011 don't have to give that information, only people with more recent convictions. But that's not what it says. It says would apply only to an individual required to register under this act after July 1, 2011. It doesn't say to apply to an individual initially required to register under this act or whose conduct occurred after. So I would look at and I'd say, well, you are an individual, right? Can we agree on that? Yes. Okay, so we've got the first part. You are an individual. It is after July 1, 2011. Would you agree with me on that? We're at the end of 2020, so we're after July 1, 2011. You are required to register, aren't you? So the way I read this, to an individual required to register under this act after July 1, 2011, you clearly are required to register because your term has not expired. So therefore, this applies to you. A sinister person could read it that way, and believe me, I'm not letting any cat out of the bag. They may have already thought about this. This may have been deliberately, they designed it this way, kind of like the lawmakers in Florida, when they designed that amendment to restore voting rights, where they could go out and try to get felons to be proud of them because we're restoring the rights of people to vote. You should feel good about us. But then they put the language in there, all obligations. And the judge looking at it says, well, all that would include everything, including your fines, would it not? Well, this exactly says, if you're a textualist, this does not exempt you the way you think it does.
Okay. So then we'll continue on with questions.
Sure.
Let's talk about how this is all about the Benjamins. The federal government sends money to states for their level of substantial complianceness with the AWA, right? Which means the more compliance, the more the merrier. Is that right?
I'm not so sure you get the money merely for complying. You don't lose money for, you don't lose that 10%. Of your burn grants for not being substantially compliant, but the days of getting a bonus, those were in the when the act first passed, there was rewards for early implementation. So what it is you don't lose money, which you can extrapolate that means you're receiving money, but you do get money for for residency verification and compliance, checking on offenders. And, you know, that's what the departments, the law enforcement departments love. That's how they put these multi-agencies together. That's all on the federal government, you know, the government that everybody hates, that they want to keep nice and small. That's where the money comes from to do that, and which is so laughable to me, because people, they want small government, but they all put their hands out to see how much they can get from the government that they wish was small.
It seems that they just want smaller. They want a different kind of government. It's like the budgets are almost the same between the two sides. They're just putting the money in different places.
Now you're going to cause me to go off on a tangent. You're going to cause me to go off on a tangent. I didn't intend to go off on Christmas. It's not possible. It's not possible to shrink the budget because most of our spending is already baked in the cake.
It's
commitments we've already made long before the people that are elected right now. I mean, like this $900 billion of COVID relief, that's not baked in the cake. But everything else the government's doing, that's already it's on automatic pilot. these are things that we do that we've already committed to doing, and so the budget's always going to be similar between the two sides because we've already preordained this spending.
All right, somebody kick that soapbox out from underneath Larry so we can keep going. Else? You don't have a whole lot else here for us to cover, I don't think.
I did want to mention I don't like states who charge fees, and it was in a fiscal impact report that I plucked this figure out. It says the Sex Offender Registry Unit of the Michigan State Police has a gross annual budget of approximately $1 million. 100% of which comes from the Sex Offender Registration Fund. The fund is supported by fees collected from a $50 annual fee paid by registered sex offenders required to periodically report to local registering authority. And I think that is really, really sad. Clearly it's a money racket. Now, $50 doesn't seem like a lot for some, but if you're struggling, $50 is an awful lot of money, particularly if you're homeless. That's a good thing. They did exempt the homeless from having to have a state-issued ID or driver's license. Now that's not a marked license. It's just everybody has to have a state-issued driver's, chauffeur's license or an ID issued in Michigan, and they exempted the homeless from having that requirement.
I always wonder about these, I guess from a civil regulatory scheme, you pay to get your driver's license, so that's I'm trying to draw that comparison there. But if you don't do it, forget the homeless people, if you don't go pay that money, can we make the assumption that you then go to prison for not paying your $50 fee a year?
Well, yes, you potentially could. And there appears to be some ways for waiver for indigents and for people who fit below the poverty level as defined by federal law or their own means-tested programs, but not paying that fee can result, and it's not as serious of a violation. The way I read the law, it was a misdemeanor on the first offense that carried up to a year in the county jail. But yes, you have to pay the fee, but the same thing happens with your driver's license. It's not the $50 would carry you for probably many years on a driver's license. I think we pay something like $32 for 8 years here.
Correct. Same. So like for 10 years here, you pay your thing. Okay, great. So if you amortize that out, you're paying like $3, $4, $5 a year. You're paying 50 cents a month.
These fees are quite substantial. And Michigan's not on the high end. The states that levy fees, we've heard the horror stories from Louisiana, the fee plus the notification cost that they pile on the registrant for the mailouts that they require. So it is about the money. There are a lot of people, law enforcement officers and others who make their living off of the registry.
So you know you go to prison for not spending the $50. Where else? So she's going to sign it, and does this provide relief for half of everybody? Does this provide relief for everybody? Is it tiered in how it provides relief for people?
Well, it looks like it's going to provide relief for everybody who was pre-2011, the way I read it. And as far as the tier designations, it looks like they're not going to put those on for anyone, which I would say that is some kind of a victory for everybody. if you've got this tier three thing hanging over you and you haven't had any process, and the public perceives you as being the most dangerous, that would be a win. That would be a win clearly if that's no longer on the website for everyone. I mean, you'd have to concede that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, totally. Now everyone just gets mixed together. I gotcha. How about a person in chat, not Steve, in chat says, will the changes that the AG have any bearing on the SORNA clarification sought by William Barr a few months back?
I think it's probably a little too early to say, because that is still unfolding in terms of what states will want to do. I didn't see any evidence that in this legislation that's even come into their minds yet. But I mean, they're largely compliant with everything that Michigan is substantially compliant. So I don't think that they spent a lot of time trying to go back and figure out how to be AWA compliant, because they already have been granted that designation. So I don't see that being significant at this point.
Would you do me a favor and reword the question so that I don't exactly understand it, and you explained the answer, but could you reword the question?
Well, I put forth my concern that when I saw the proposed regulations that the small government attorney general put out, which were adopted, it was a roadmap for states who had not passed legislation to do a lot of things through administrative action. But Michigan didn't need to do that. They had already done all the stuff through legislative action to be AWA compliant. That's going to be more impactful on states who have not been able to pass the legislation through their processes. But like, for example, the 21-day advance notice. If a state hasn't incorporated that into their registry scheme, there's nothing that stops the federal government, the SMART office, that's the monitoring registration apparatus in D.C., from providing the registering units forms and saying, have your offenders sign these. They did that in West Virginia. And then they have de facto incorporated that into the state registry scheme, even though the state assembly didn't adopt it, because they've provided them. So they're going to do that on a lot of things where the states have not enacted the law. They're just going to work with law enforcement units and have them go ahead and start doing these things. And that's my concern. And I don't think it's an overly pessimistic concern. I think that's what they will do.
Anything else before we lightning round some articles?
Oh, no, I think we need to get moving.
Okay. That's complicated stuff, Larry. Oh, but then what happens next, though? Does like the Miriam Ackermans, does the ACLU fire up the legal challenge machine and go to town again?
I think there's that potential. I would not want to speak for them, but they had grand ideas of getting more comprehensive reform than what came out of this, but they got what, there's a difference between what you want and what you want. What you want in court, they got. That's what the legislature did. They fixed the thing that the court was concerned about. And I think in pre-show banter, I gave you a little scenario. If you have a dispute with your property, with your neighbor, and they've encroached on your property, and you go to court to try to get them, the judge to order them to remove the encroaching structure or fence, whatever they've done. After you've won that, and you didn't introduce the other things, and you didn't win, you may have introduced them, but you didn't win on the other things, you can't come back and say, now I want these things, because you didn't win the part that the roosters are making too much noise at night. You didn't win the part that the top of the barn that he uses for an outhouse is all rusty. I mean, you didn't win that. You won the encroachment, and that's what they got. They got the things they won.
Very good. All right. Let's take over to an article from law.com. Ghislaine Maxwell's attorney proposed $28.5 million bail package in renewed motion for release. Why did you put this in here?
It just gives me a chance to opine about how the country has gotten this has virtually no chance of being granted. And it destroys the presumption of innocence. There's no way she can work with her defense team in the Metropolitan Correctional Center with the COVID restrictions and the complexity of this case and the very limited access. Therefore, this person will not get due process of law. And I know I'm going to get criticized because everybody can't afford a $28 million bail package. And Larry,
easy,
if you just
peasy,
understood,
man, I got it in my checkbook right now.
Yeah. If you just understood that this isn't fair, but what bail is supposed to be is to assure the person's appearance at court. That's all it's for. We don't get into the analysis of guilt or innocence. It's we want you to come back and see us. Is all bail is supposed to be for. Now it's evolved into alcohol treatment and counseling and GPS monitoring and all these other things, but that's not what bail is supposed to be for, because you're totally presumed innocent, and an innocent person should have their liberty, right?
Let me play devil's advocate for just a minute. This woman has resources and would flee.
That's what they're saying.
So where does that then fit into the equation of, it would be cheaper to let her be at home and put some sort of 24-hour guard watching her. It would be cheaper than having her locked up and safer as far as COVID goes.
That's exactly what she proposed, and she's going to pay for the security.
Okay. So then why wouldn't they allow that? I mean, that's still then allowing a rich person to sort of buy their way out of. That is being treated differently for her than for Joe Schmo. But why wouldn't they allow that?
Because of the mob mentality, that public anger. But I'm saying everybody should get out. I'm not just saying the rich person should get out. I'm saying that I believe everyone. I believe the police officer that we see shoot a person and tase a person on camera, they should get out because they're presumed innocent. I'm saying this about everyone. We just need to do what's minimally necessary to reasonably assure their participation. And then secondarily, we want to keep the community safe. So we need to have evidence that the person would go out and jeopardize public safety if they were out. But other than that, I'm saying everyone should be roaming because you're presumed innocent. So I'm not being a hypocrite at all. I want everybody out pre-trial.
Yeah. And Charles has an interesting question. You know, her picture's been plastered all over the media. She's a fairly well-recognized person at this point. So how could the most recognized person be able to run away?
Well, therein lies the problem. I don't think the flight, and anybody can run away. I mean, whether you have gobs of money or limited money, I mean, you have more options when you have gobs of money, but people disappear with very limited money. But I'm convinced that she poses minimal risk for flight. And I can't say that zero, because no one poses zero risk, but she's too recognizable. She's not going to disappear into thin air.
I guess one of her attorneys said, if Miss Maxwell were to violate her bail conditions, which she has no intention of doing, she would be leaving her spouse with virtually nothing. It's unfathomable that Miss Maxwell would abandon her family, which she has fought so hard to protect, under these circumstances.
So, well, that
what
was
you're ultimately saying is our system is incredibly cruel. That's what you're ultimately saying, I think.
I'm saying that we do not actually believe in that presumption of innocence. If we did, we would release almost everyone because they're an innocent person, right?
That's innocent until proven guilty, right?
And I said almost everyone. I'm not saying everyone, but I'm saying if we can fashion a package of conditions that would reasonably assure a person's participation, if they're not previously on supervision and in violation of terms of supervision, we need to release almost everyone pre-trial because under our system, they're presumed innocent. And I say it about everyone. I know some people hate when they see a police officer do something awful on camera. And I say the same thing. I think I've said it consistently. He or she deserves to be out on bail, participating in their defense, and the presumption of innocence should follow them all the way through the process.
It's interesting. And you already said this, but I just want to bring it up again. The protection firm, the private security firm, said it would post $1 million of its own money to support the bond for Miss Maxwell. So $28 million bond means, you know, she's going to pay like 3 million bonds. So they're putting up not quite half of the money for her to have bond on, of their own cash. That's amazing.
So, well, it's not likely to be granted, and that's sad, you know.
All right. And then, and again, over from
I'm not saying it's okay if the accusations are proven true, but I'm saying what the police say. They say you haven't heard the whole story. Every time a law enforcement officer is accused of a crime, they say, wait till all the facts are in. Don't prejudge. I'm only asking the same thing. Let's not prejudge this case. Let's do what the police recommend. Let's wait until the facts come in and the judgment's made. That's all I'm asking, is for consistency.
Right. All right. Over at WBUR, which is from Boston, Massachusetts prisoners among the first to get COVID vaccines. Now, that's a crazy idea, Larry. Why would we want to give the inmates the COVID vaccine before everyone else?
Well, I just put that in here. I didn't even read it very carefully, but it shows that in these liberal do-good states that sometimes they get some things right, because you got people who have no ability to acquire protective gear for themselves. They have no ability to distance themselves. They have no ability to control anything about their environment. And they're the most susceptible to the COVID, other than probably the nursing homes. And I think that I need to give kudos to Massachusetts for doing the right thing. Maybe other states will follow.
Okay. We could probably skip after that one. And then, so then this is from ABC. It says, OC sheriff ordered by judge to reduce county jail's population by half amid COVID pandemic. If the order stands, it will result in the release of more than 1,800 inmates. Crazy town. We don't want to release people, Larry.
You ain't got to release anybody. All you have to do is cut the jail population. See, that's the scare tactics they use. You don't have to release a soul. It's just you have to put them in other facilities other than that structure.
Oh, which could be their home.
It could be. It could be a halfway house. It could be another facility that you've purchased space from. There's actually facilities that have extra space for rent, even in this COVID environment. But you don't have to release anybody. So
I gotcha. That's an interesting play on words there. So in order to release 50% of the population, but saying you could put them on leg monitors, just as an example, and let them go about their days.
Yeah, they're being ordered to cut their population. That doesn't necessarily translate to release.
I see. I gotcha. Anything else before we move on from this one?
Fantastic. It's a fantastic ruling. I hope that it actually happens.
Okay. And then out of Louisiana, Louisiana AG asks SCOTUS, Supreme Court of the United States, to halt ruling that struck down part of state's SO law, ID law. What is this?
Well, this is actually, the state has the right to do that. We talked, I never can remember the episode numbers, but we talked about that ruling. I think it's like 5 episodes back, about the Supreme Court of Louisiana striking down the driver's license marking. And since they did it on the basis of the U.S. Constitution, once you've exhausted the highest tribunal in your jurisdiction, if it's a federal constitution issue, you can take it to the U.S. Supreme Court. So what they have done is they have asked the Supreme Court to halt this. And I did a skim read of the thing before we started recording, and they've put all kind of scare tactics in the petition, and they've put this before. The way the Supreme Court works is when there's an emergency petition come in, each circuit has a Supreme Court justice assigned to it. And in the case this, Louisiana's in the Fifth. The Fifth Circuit is headquartered in New Orleans. And the Fifth Circuit, the Supreme Court justice assigned to the Fifth is Alito. And to refresh your memory, the Gundy decision, he was a dissenter because he said that the sex offenders were such a despised population that nobody wanted to do anything for them. Do you remember that quote, something to that effect? That he would be willing okay. Well, we had people out there just salivating about what a wonderful Justice Scalia was and how he really would have wanted to help the offenders, but it was those libtards that wouldn't do it. So now he's got something on his plate where he can actually help to sex offenders. As the Supreme Court justice for that circuit, he could help the sex offenders. He could, but he's not likely to, but he could deny the request to stay this and let that process take place and play out at the local level in the state of Louisiana and let them be forced to deal with that ruling of their Supreme Court. But we will find out if he was grandstanding because he hated the administrative state or if he actually does have a soft spot in his heart for sexual offenders, won't we? We'll find out.
Right. And to clarify, that's episode 150, RM 150, to where we did the Louisiana Supreme Court rules ID law unconstitutional.
So, well, I just can't wait to see what Justice Alito does because I told people he was only making those comments because of his hatred for the administrative state and how he wants to dismantle it. But here's his chance to show that I was wrong. And believe me, I hope I can come back on this podcast and say I had it all wrong, that he does have a soft spot in his heart. So I'm looking forward to what he does.
Are you actually like drawing a line in the sand for any of our listeners to come back and point to saying that you were wrong on this issue?
I'm saying I hope I'm wrong.
I hope you're saying you are, but...
I really am.
I'm making the challenge on your behalf, though. I'm making that challenge. I want somebody to like follow this and come back and say, "You scumbag, Larry." See,
well, I'm hoping that they can do that because I think that he has no interest in sexual offenders. But we have, he has the opportunity now. In full disclosure, he could show us that he has that soft heart by issuing the order denying it, but. Anything that a Supreme Court judge that's over circuit, any emergency relief that they grant can be dissolved. But he doesn't really have to grant any relief. He just has to deny their petition, their emergency petition. And then it has to go through the regular certiorari process, which means that it would take many, many weeks or probably a few months before they would decide whether they're going to take Louisiana's case. But they said in the emergency document to Justice Alito that we know that you're going to grant cert. We know that this is such an important issue that the Supreme Court's going to hear it. I'm not so sure about that. But they're putting forth their theory about government speech, which came up in our Georgia case with the Butts County Sheriff. So they're putting forth a similar argument about this isn't compel speech, this is government speech, and that the offender cannot, there's no way that you could assume the offender endorsed this speech. And they're saying that, for example, near the end of the petition, they said, we just had a hurricane here and we had to evacuate. And without this marking, the agencies that were housing these people, they wouldn't have known. And they would have mixed the offenders in with the regular population. And that could be very dangerous. And they use every scare tactic in the book that they could come up with. But we'll see what Alito does, because I know he has that soft spot in his heart for sexual offenders.
Absolutely. And then another thing from Louisiana, it's from the Advocate. Louisiana legislators look at options to increase reliability of sex offender registry. This seems almost like saying military intelligence, because, like, I mean, reliability for something that doesn't need accuracy because the people that are on the registry are the ones that are not typically offending to begin with. So it seems sort of counterproductive to even say that there needs to be reliability in the registry. How about that?
Well, there's a lot of inaccuracy. We've had various organizations do studies and send out mail, and the addresses are wrong. But this more focused on the tier levels being wrong. They've got the tier system, and as I said in the previous segment, we talk about tiers and we associate that with dangerousness. Well, they make that point in this thing here that the public perceives based on the tier, and people who don't have the right listing tier level with their registration could convey that someone is dangerous that really isn't, or vice versa. They could be, I think the quote was, there could be a predator out there roaming and people would mistakenly not know it because of the inaccuracy. But no one takes responsibility for the accuracy of the registry. They have every law enforcement entity that can put stuff in, enter the registry information, and no one owns the responsibility to keep it accurate. So they got this liberal do-good named Jay Leno from Alexandria that's trying to clarify who on earth should be responsible for the accuracy and integrity of that list. And nobody knows.
Well, Where do you think this will then go?
Probably nowhere.
Okay.
Well, I mean, honestly, the reason why is that to do this better is going to cost more money. And nobody wants to spend more money. Louisiana is not, I mean, they have one of the worst public defender systems in the country. They have one of the most oppressive registry in terms of the ID, in terms of the cost they put on a registrant. And they don't want to spend any money. So if this is going to cost additional money, they're not going to want to allocate it because we got to keep taxes low. Maybe. So I just don't see that there's a lot of incentive to put more money into being more accurate with the registry. So the answer is I don't expect nothing to be done.
All right. It sounds like then you would want they would want to create another bureaucracy to monitor the bureaucracy.
Well, according to the article, the Louisiana State Police has a supervisor and three employees working on the registry, but they don't have any personal contact with the offenders. So therefore, I mean, they're saying we're not the best ones to know this. I mean, it's not our job. We don't know all this stuff, but it's going to require more money. It's the same reason why everybody who wants to go to a risk-based system, the reason why you can't pass a risk-based system is because it costs money.
Very good. Is there anything else? That's all we have of content tonight. I don't think there were any new patrons, so you slackers for not becoming new patrons. Right here at the very end of the year, we have now fallen shy of our goal. But I will let it slide because it's Christmas.
Aren't we just like five away?
It's a little more than five away, but it's not terribly far. It's like we have 83-ish or something like that. And we were trying to be at 100 for the end of the year.
Well,
so it's not that far away.
It's possible to get 17 in the next week.
It is very possible. So if you haven't, become one at $1 a month, and we would greatly, greatly appreciate it. And then we would achieve our numbers, and we can have like a big party, and I can blow streamers on the podcast and all that stuff. But otherwise, Larry, we are. Is there anything else before we go through some final notes of the year?
I think that other than holiday wishes and going through our final sign-off, we've covered it.
All right. Because next week we're not going to record. It'll be the day after Christmas, and I will be visiting family and so forth. And this will be the sign-off for the year, and we love you guys very much and appreciate all that you do for us and listening into us every week. And Larry, I do deeply hope that you have a wonderful Christmas holiday season and get some rest, and maybe you won't be so cranky next year.
I hope so.
Visit us over at registrymatters.co. Call in 747-227-4477. registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And of course, the best way is to support the podcast over at patreon.com/registrymatters. Thank you for another year, Larry. I greatly appreciate it. And I hope you have a wonderful Saturday night.
Thank you, Andy.
Good night. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to FYP.